I'm going to talk first about industrial relations and the bigger picture. I mean, for the last, say, 20 years or so, there has been a crisis, well, described as a crisis in industrial relations. So, I mean, Streeck talks about the employment models in flux. Also, Kalin and Hu talk about variations of liberalization and flexibilization in industrial relations. And the starting point for this is, I mean, historically we have seen that in liberal countries you have a high degree of decentralization and voluntarism, in the sense that industrial relations are mostly happening at the workplace level, with some sectoral backup, but hardly at the national level. In contrast to Denmark, has a coordinated economy where there is a lot of coordination across all levels, despite the fact that Denmark also has a voluntary system and no defined labor law. So this is kind of the historical situation. Then you have this curious kind of curious incidents in 1987 in Ireland, and also in the 90s in Denmark, where this kind of seems to be worse. So there is more centralization in Ireland and more decentralization in Denmark going on. And we have two graphs to kind of show how this has changed from a high degree of coordination and a high degree of liberalization or decentralization to something in the middle. The first one shows wage coordination, and you can see the blue line in Denmark. This kind of fluctuates, but seems to level around the mid-level coordination, and the same for government intervention. That seems to have increased in Ireland from exactly here the late 80s quite significantly to reach a higher stage, a higher level than in Denmark. So the state has become an actor and a guardian in both countries to protect what is there. So given all these processes and let's say Taylor's argument about deregulation, flexibilization, liberalization, how does this actually work in the two countries? Because we kind of can see centralization, decentralization going on in both countries, but how does it work? Is it the same or not the same? And what we propose to argue is that while it's not really the same, obviously, so if you distinguish the three levels, you can see, yes, of course, but in both countries there is a high degree of centralization at the peak level. So et al. Talks to the Danish Employers Organization. In Ireland you had the national agreements that acted as a coordination device at the top level. But then it's already kind of tickling or breaking apart, and then Denmark, the state acts as a guardian to the process, so it doesn't really get involved in, let's say, the day-to-day negotiations which are taking place at lower levels, especially for wages, which takes place at the workplace level mostly. While in Ireland, the state tried to be an actor, provides tax cuts, benefit payments, and so on, already said. So they are giving, after redistribution, a high degree of welfare as well. But then it comes to different practices in the sectors, partially along the lines of foreign versus national companies or native companies, human resource strategies at the sector level, and also managerial autonomy at the workplace level, so kind of the deliberate work organization. And to see how these dynamics play out, first to talk about Denmark, then compare the two countries again, and then talk about Ireland. So in Denmark, what we can see is that the wages are increasingly set at the workplace. So despite the collective agreements at the sectoral level and the kind of overarching coordination of what the wages should be, these more or less function as a base level from which companies can negotiate increases or how they do it. What we also can see is that non-wage issues, such as training funds, childcare funds, etc., are increasingly incorporated into the sectoral bargains between trade unions and employers. That, in a way, they substitute for some restrictions on the wage negotiations. So if they can't increase wages as they would like to, they can at least have a fund that pays some other benefits to this. But doing this kind of, in a way you could argue that this weakens the state or the governmental welfare system. If some of those, let's say also welfare issues are incorporated into sectoral bargains, but at the same time it strengthens the inter-industrial relations system because the social partners have more capabilities to attract workers to become members, attract companies to be part of it. So that we can find here as an overview how this works out compared to Ireland, where you also have some of the non-wage issues negotiated in social pacts, but at the macro level, with some attempts to kind of let them trickle down to the major micro level, but very difficultly. And reasons for this, if you look at the dynamics in Ireland along the same timeline roughly, is that in the after 94, you kind of had the growth period and where the reforms and the coordination at the national level paid off, which was then followed until the early 2000s by a project to kind of also expand the capacities at the meso level by creating partnerships in different areas. So to create kind of a foundation for future growth and stability, which then again changed in the 2000s when politics, even if social democracy is without politics, but politics took over again, and what became important was to spend money, not necessarily to prepare for the future. And how does this then look after the change in crisis? So what we can see in Ireland is that the state tried to amass some power again, central power, to direct the development of Ireland, but there are not necessarily strong mechanisms to get these into the different sectors and areas of society. So it kind of confirms that the public system is a bit is weaker, or refrains from making a huge investment in favor of private initiatives or the church in the area of welfare. So what you have then is actually a segmented or silo institutional arrangements. In Denmark, not everything is very easy in the during and after the crisis, but you still have this aim or the negotiation to find the balance and an agreement between the different institutions, and this game is repeated over and over again, which hopefully ensures that it will continue in the future as well. There are some tripartite meetings between social partners and the state, which are not without their problems, but they eventually find some option to do this. And but apart from these days, there are threats to this, and we are still kind of thinking what are the breaking points of the Danish model. So where could be developments that kind of pull this negotiation, the coordination, and the many ties between the institutions apart. And some of these are just listed here, supposed employers undercutting the Danish social standards, yellow unions providing unemployment benefits but without participating in the coordination of the agreements, and to some extent also the EU, which has lower standards than the Danish would like. Now, I will move this now down to the very micro level. So our case study is in IT in Denmark and Ireland to see how relations and national forms of capitalism working out there. And in a way, the leading question is, first, you know, is it the forefront of economic development? Or how the Silicon Valley model, so one particular model that is dominant in this area, plays out in two different economies. And just for introduction, you can see that Denmark and Ireland have a good share of employment in ICT. In Ireland, it's nearing the Danish level, but you also have differences. In Denmark, ICT is more incorporated in the, let's say, industrial sectors. You have Maersk, you have the wind companies that have huge ICT or IT departments and provide a lot of employment. You have the TDC, which is the national telephone company that provide a lot of IT employment in Ireland. You essentially have US companies, HP, Intel down the road, in Dublin, around the docks, Google, Facebook, and so forth. So it's a different type of company that already comes in. And how do we analyze then the workplace organizations in these two countries to see where the differences are and how the Silicon Valley model plays out into an Irish and a Danish version? And we follow Burr Boy's manufacturing consent idea, so we look into three related aspects of work organization, effort boundaries and careers. And in the blue circles, you would find what are the defining aspects in IT for each of those efforts, project teams, mobile careers, and deadlines. Talking about careers first, I mean, to some extent, you could define it as first employment mobility and then employment mobility. So two aspects within the same thing. So the first thing is you secure employment about essentially income. So while you're working, you get a lot of income and you play your game around getting your share for your skills, while at the same time knowing that employment won't be a long-term relationship. It won't be employment like at Ford or, I don't know, Volkswagen or wherever, where you can expect to work for that company forever. But it will be basically around projects, small number of years, 2-3 years, and then you move on. And for this, obviously, you need capacities to be mobile, some networks, reputations, etc. Yet, in order of this, what we also found in our case studies is it's important what the environment is generally. So you have some large firms that provide long-term employment, but also give the expertise, they train the people, they provide managerial expertise, bureaucratic expertise, etc. And then you have a bunch of small firms around this that kind of provide the innovation and leading cutting edge technology with which the economy can grow. And we have selected two quotes which are symptomatic for the two types of mobilities in the countries. So in Denmark, you kind of understand that in order to be mobile, you also need to have a good set of skills. And despite the employers not necessarily providing this anymore, especially in the case studies that we had, which were small companies, you kind of still understand that, okay, I need to learn new skills and then I can move on and move to another project. In Ireland, the approach seems to be much more like, well, there's a huge labor market and there's a high demand for the skills I have, so it will be very easy for me to move to any company as long as I worked in the right ones before. Now, going to the effort part of the bargain. This is an interview in Denmark done with an Italian-born IT worker who has been in Denmark for a few years already. And we also have spoken to a Greek or a couple of Greek IT workers and some non-Danish workers who had the same approach, is that in Denmark it seems to be much more about the group rather than the individual. So while the individual is important in developing a project and they get rewarded for their skills or special set of skills, what it counts at the end of the day is how the group performs. So they have to blend in into the group, they have to be part of the group, and not, this kind of nobody wants to be the leader. So if someone sticks out, it is regarded as somehow problematic to the success of the company. So that if you look at the right side here, especially this one is the Jamte law, who we have been told that somehow what you should do at work is really to be part of the group and not stick out and go around and brag how good you are. Try to contribute to the group, and that is the best strategy that you want. That this is not always positive. We also have heard that some managers, but also foreign workers, that at sometimes they wish that the IT workers would not just behave like civil service employees, but really be IT workers who stay in the office 16 hours a day and work until they drop or fall asleep. In Ireland, it's a different picture. So the workers we talked to, they always emphasized their special set of skills, that they bring certain key expertise into the company, also in relation to their colleagues, that their colleagues are the right persons at the right position at the right time. And that it's much more organized around individuals, and that obviously the company rewards this much more than at the team effort. And the third point is about time. And as we found that my time was running out, and we were worried that we couldn't fill the time. But anyway, so what we found is that obviously the second amendment somehow evolves around never leaving the company. So you work and work and work, and you sleep at the workplace, you eat, you have your children there, whatever. This is, to some extent, is the case in Ireland. And in the worst case, it's basically you really are there and you have no private life. It's not the case in Denmark, at least from what our interviewees told us. They leave work usually around 4, so the usual time that everyone in Denmark would leave work. But obviously they might also log into the system at 8, 9:30 once the children are in bed and breakfast, dinner was eaten to do a bit more work. And here you can see, especially in the aspect of time, how management is important. And this is another factor that we saw as a difference between the two countries, that explain to this. So in Ireland, you would have essentially manager gives a key target and then you have to deal with it. In Denmark, it is again the negotiation aspect, the coordination. So there's freedom to renegotiate deadlines, which obviously makes the pressures at work and the work organization much more relaxed, in inverted commas. And that led us to think about what is making good manager, right? So it seems then that in Ireland there's a bad manager type prevalent, and in Denmark it's a good manager existent. And one of our interviewees, he compared this to kind of the worker in the rain metaphor. So in a good manager would control the rain above the workers. So by deciding what actually is relevant for the worker to know and to do at the moment, and by this keeping stress down. A bad manager would essentially just let it rain and let the worker deal with whatever comes up. And to explain this, we thought that in Denmark, which seems to be the good manager place, there is obviously, because of the environment of collective agreements, the high coordination between social partners, legislation around working environments, so certain requirements that you need to fulfill, no matter how large the company is, managers are forced to be good, and workers expect this. There's a norm around what managers should do and cannot do. And this obviously supports everything that that we have. So, in addition to this, it's not just the manager that is good, but also in Denmark, what you find is that you have the welfare state and the regulations around which make this employment game and the Silicon Valley model less stressful. So, in other words, the outcome of the finding is probably, or the question whether Silicon Valley plays a role is that there is some form of Silicon Valley in Denmark, but it's a Danish version. This is the usual answer we find. There's a Danish model of Silicon Valley going on, which is very close, very similar to the other sectors in Denmark, so a high standard employment model. Okay?
Good.
Okay, so just to briefly pull all that together, I suppose we've talked about a number of different things here and how the kind of the Danish and Irish models work, but before just kind of pulling together how that works across the different levels, if you think about what are the ways that people characterize the different worlds of capitalism today, kind of in an era of liberalization and so on, and Kathleen Talen's very interesting book about varieties of liberalization talks about three different forms. The Nordics as kind of embedded flexibility, the liberals as deregulation, and the continental economies as these dualists. I'm not going to talk much about that. But just to say that the deregulation doesn't really tell you exactly what a huge amount of what is going on in Ireland, in the sense that there's a whole form of, in the stories we've been telling, there's a whole set of ways of coordination that are present that aren't really captured by deregulation. And at the same time, there's another insight from economic sociology where the market is, in a sense, always embedded. So in that sense, all of these systems should be forms of embedded flexibility. The question is, what kind of flexibility and what kind of embeddedness? So what we'll just do in the next 4 minutes or so is just briefly kind of summarize what we've talked about in those terms. And if you think about what are the kind of liberal and social democratic varieties of embedded flexibility, both have quite extensive market mechanisms at work. So if you think, looking across all of this, you see that, for example, civil society, state and labor are very strongly networked through these structured collective agreements in Denmark, whereas the direct relations between employers and unions in Ireland are much less continuous and more focused around particular issues of points of conflict rather than an ongoing process of kind of negotiation. And we were talking about expertise this morning, and one of the, it was interesting for us, for example, going into a round of bargaining that the retail union and the retail employers association had commissioned a study together of part-time work in the retail industry. And they agreed that this would be the evidence base for the discussion. And this is in the private sector. Now, they then violently disagreed about what it actually meant, but that was a different story. They had committed themselves from the beginning to that piece of research, which was carried out by the University of Copenhagen. So, there's a structure there within civil society that isn't present. That changes the role of the state. The state is the kind of guardian of the process in Denmark. Very rarely gets involved as a direct actor in the way that the state got involved, famously Bertie Ahern arriving into various pubs around town to fix social, deals at the last minute and so on. The nature of that was quite different in that government action was much more around, tax arrangements and so on, whereas the adjustments from the on the Danish side, were much more around funds for building capabilities, whether it's leave, work-life balance, training, those kinds of issues were, that was the main kind of way of trading off wages for, you know, wages for wage restraints for some kind of benefit. What kind of benefits you get if you got these capabilities for managing these issues that were non-wage issues. Whereas in a sense, you were chasing those issues with income in the Irish model. Although there were attempts, especially in the 1990s, to try and build those in Ireland, but were much less successful than in Denmark. And then what was interesting then with the IT, and the reason we looked at IT was because of the, you know, both places are following the Silicon Valley model, but they're following it in different ways. And you can see that those capabilities that are built in through the central national agreements and national negotiations play a role in how the Silicon Valley model operates in Denmark compared to in Ireland, for example. And even that's an industry where there isn't a lot of union, you know, more unionization than in Ireland, but still not a lot of unionization, a lot of employment, mobility, technology, technical communities, all that kind of stuff. But nonetheless, you get these kind of mechanisms that bring more capabilities into the level of the firm, generalize those investments across the workforce, and put pressure on managers to manage as if work-life balance really matters and so on. This whole idea of the good manager is not that necessarily managers per se are better, but that they work in different contexts of capabilities and coordination. So you have extensive market mechanisms, and in some ways in Denmark the protection, you know, the market runs, when it runs, but it runs with these very dense network of protections around the market through these capabilities and investments, not just regulations, but capabilities that are built into the market. Whereas in the liberal model, the protections are really more in the market itself. Coordination through networked agreements versus coordination through either personal networks or hierarchical coordination, either government or managers. So ironically, in a sense, the liberal economies, in a sense, have much more hierarchical mechanisms of coordination. And in a sense, these create a kind of a demand backwards, because if your manager has more arbitrary power, then you need more rules around your job. You know, who wants to sign up for flexibility when the manager has all the say over what the flexibility is, and so on. Right. Whereas, as Fallon says, markets can actually be an equalizing force in particular industries if they operate in, you know, this particular context where they're set up in a sense as markets should operate. And that's what I want to finish with, which is when you look at when you take markets seriously and ask what are the things that are supposed to make markets work, you can look at what are some of the different dimensions of markets. So key dimensions would be rationality, full information, equal bargaining power, unique equilibrium. You could probably add a few more, but those for us, good amount to get started with. And what you can see is, that these get organized differently in the two different societies. So the way that the market works, for markets to work, and these are assumptions that are often, you know, just said at the beginning, but if you take them seriously and say, you know, for a market to work, it needs these things to be present. I think what our case studies are showing us is that for these to work, you need all kinds of things to be around the market that have nothing to do with the market. Networks, agreements, investments, and so on. So the market never exists like separate from those institutions that are there to make it real. So you have a different way of making markets real in Denmark and in Ireland. And in some ways, we were struck across a whole range of areas, labor markets, mortgages, whatever it is, that when the market runs, it runs. Like if you can't pay your mortgage, you're out. Now, your chances of actually paying your mortgage are better because, you know, they've got all kinds of things in, but. Okay, so, I won't labor the point, but basically what we're arguing here is that the structure of negotiation around the Danish labor market in particular provides a lot of these key elements. And that even when you're looking at equilibrium, happens in this context where the negotiation process is, in a sense, determining the equilibrium, or at least setting the parameters of how you will work out your negotiate your equilibrium. Whereas in Ireland, for example, the equilibrium is much more erratic, and your ability to say, I'll give up something now because I think I'll get it back 3 years from now in the next round, is much less than in Denmark. So we'll leave it there, basically to end on just saying that in a sense, rather than thinking of these as, you know, embedded flexible versus deregulated, that in a sense, these are about two different forms of embedded flexibilities. That's it.
Great, thanks very much to Felix and Sean, and obviously that's other people's work coming in as well, John Paul,
yeah.
who couldn't be here today. So in terms of timetabling, we've a nice 15 minutes before coffee, so we'll just take it off from there, maybe take two or three questions and wrap them up first. Ben?
I mean, before you beginning of dreaming of working in Denmark, you have managers as well who are not properly working. I think there's a huge split between different sectors in Denmark. There's a different split between the public sector and the private sector. It's more, I would say, a collective agreement process within the public sector, because there it's much more difficult to sack people. You can do it in the private sector, and you're increasingly doing it within the public sector as well. So I'm on one side, I was sitting back dreaming, saying, is this really Denmark you're listening to? So, I mean, of course, there are these institutions and they're working, but I also have an increasingly problem with what we call yellow trade unions. So the strength of the classical trade unions are weakening. And also due to what was said also this morning, that we have more in underemployed people, we have more bogus self-employed, we have more in types of job where they don't have a fixed contract. So I think there are a lot of these elements I can recognize, but I think you are going too far, sorry to say it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good provocative opening. John?
Two quick questions. First one is that slide right there. Why are erratic futures equilibrium? That's first question. Doesn't sound like that would be the appropriate phrase. And then, to be provocative a little bit, some of the graphs that you showed, and Sean, particularly your last comment about, you know, they're all embedded. It's a question of what the embeddedness looks like. This sounds a lot to me like a major challenge to the varieties of capitalism, in the sense that, is it the case that you guys are describing a shift towards increasingly hybrid models? So that it may have been the case 20 years ago that the varieties of capitalism framework works, but everybody changes, everybody adjusts, and now there's some sort of a convergence on some kind of hybrid-like thing.
Okay, thank you. And Rory down the back for one last one, and then we'll bring it back.
Just very briefly, in terms of the question of why they're different, and take it that there is still a significant difference in terms of the models between Denmark and Ireland, what role do you think it does come back to politics and the trade unions, and in terms of that balance of power, and that we have never kind of had that assertion of trade union power of left politics in Ireland the way Denmark had historically, and therefore that, you know, explains a significant part of that difference.
Okay, so you've got three nice questions there. I don't know which way you want to divide them up. Yeah, it's only well taking three. I mean, the don't live the dream, the erratic equilibriums, and are we getting towards hybrid models, and then the role of politics, and particularly the historical role of trade unions. So, flip a coin?
I can do the trade union one.
Okay. Yeah, okay, yeah.
Do you want to kick off with that?
Yeah, so the trade union, to some extent, yes. I mean, what we also heard this morning, that there is a tendency to have more coalitions in Denmark. So the balance of interests there's a high balance of interest, and trade unions and employers are part of this network, so you cannot have an extreme position on either side. And we have found this in the interviews with the both employers and also trade unions, that they have ideological differences. That is very clear. One wants to make money and the other one wants to have a higher wage. But they have a mutual interest in keeping the other ones alive. And it was one of the, I think the second interview we did was with the Employers Association. And yes, they talked about the unfeasible demands of trade unions that they have, but they also said, and they said they are too big and they are in problems and all this, and you know, they don't get enough members anymore. But they also said we have an interest that they don't die. We have an interest that they're not necessarily replaced by yellow unions, so you know, essentially meaning no union at all. For the reason that they needed someone on the other side that can keep up peace or the deal, right? So I would say, or we would say probably from the project research, there is, yes, it's about the politics, so there are differences between the political landscape in Ireland and Denmark, and certainly the Danish trade unions had a better standing and getting politically heard. But on the other hand, there is also a network at the level below that is keeping the thing together and makes it work differently than it does in Ireland. So much more, you know, going for coffees together, going for lunch. So coordination will be, you know, below coordination in a way. So mutually shared interests in each other.
Okay, thank you. Sean, do you want to take a
tweet? Yeah, I mean, I would... I'll say something on the trade unions. I mean, you know, I suppose you could say, well, there was a trade union struggle and the Danish unions won and the Irish unions lost, like in the early part of the 20th century. So in that sense, that set a set of labour relations in place, you know, and I would just say part of the story is that simple. If you win, things are good, and if you lose, things are not good. And especially when you win and you get to institutionalize a system, which was, that's almost unique in Denmark. I mean, to win an institutional system that's still running 115 years later or whatever is quite unusual, you know. So then I would think, you know, where were unions sitting? You know, they were like, in a way, trying to negotiate. There's a quote there from, I think it's from David's, somebody in David's book, but it's like, you know, doing social democracy without the politics, without the basis in place. So then the question is, you know, so then it's about the balance of negotiation and organizing and all those kinds of things. But the other side of that then is the Danish model, and we've definitely emphasized the positive side of the story here, because every time we do a comparison with. It's actually a challenge comparatively, because you do the comparison with Ireland, you know, like we used to set ourselves a parlor game of find one thing that is better in Ireland than in Denmark, you know, even though we weren't saying you want to live there, but like just in the institutional. And you know, it was a challenge other than maybe the immigration, you know. But having said that, if you look at it the other way, longitudinally within Denmark, you see definitely there are big issues there. And I think analytically that comes back to the same, to this question of the market, the embedded flexibility, and that if you let the market run, then, because it's almost Polanyian, like, that there is, it's not just, oh, you embed the market and it's all in place, that actually it is creating new actors all the time. So these IT workers are a bit better paid than other people were paid. You know, they're a bit more likely to work at 9:30 online. Suddenly that norm starts to be a little bit more eroded, you know. And you can definitely see that. And I mean, the yellow unions, these people are more likely to be in the yellow unions, where they just get the union as a service rather than as a relationship to their co-worker, which is a huge shift. And that's about 12%, I think, of the union density is around the same. It hasn't fallen off, but the 12%, about 12% of the union density is in yellow unions. So I would say that it's like shrinking the game. Like that the game, you know, the Danish system is kind of this game of negotiation pattern bargaining and so on, and that the game is kind of shrinking. And the real problem would be if the game shrunk down to a level where, like right now, your average employer wants all the other employers in the game. Because if they have to play the rules of the game, they don't want, you know, Polish employers. You know, this fictional or semi-fictional Polish employer kept coming up and was like, we're really worried about them because what happens there if they undercut us in our own backyard? So if that becomes much bigger, then you might say, see people who are firmly in the networks kind of say, oh, screw it, I'm off, you know, I'm gone, you know, I'm getting too much pressure from these guys. So there's definitely, I would say that structurally is the challenge around Denmark, that the more you let you're letting the market go a bit more, you're putting in these capabilities, and you're hoping that this will manage to hold it all together. And there's definite pressures both ways. The other thing I would just say there is, sorry, good manager. So the good manager, in a sense, we didn't necessarily mean, didn't quite explain it properly, but is it kind of an institutional form? Like, rather than, you know, there are managers who are good at managing. It's almost like, what is the expectation of the manager? What is the way you talk about the manager in the Danish IT workers versus the Irish IT workers? And the way the Irish IT workers talk about their managers is, what you get with your manager is arbitrary. You know, there are no constraints on what this manager is going to be like. You walk into the job, and is the manager going to be... Some managers are great, some of them are terrible, but you have almost no protective shell around it, which guarantees that the manager has to meet some level of, you know, competence in managing your hours or whatever. You know, if you have a terrible manager who wants you to be there till 7, tough. You know, whereas what the Danes are describing is, it is part of being a manager to manage. I'm leaving here at 4 because my child is out of childcare or whatever. Now, they might be back on at 9:30.
They also find out at times.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, and you will find out at times, but I think as a kind of a institution form, I think it's more present, certainly, than in Ireland. Then the last, yeah, is it a major challenge to VOC and is it hybrid maths? Well, it is. I mean, I suppose it is trying to think through, like, VOC. What happens if you basically break down the market versus coordination? Dualism. I think that's really what the issue is. I'm not saying I know exactly what happens when you break it down, but I don't actually have a problem so much with the coordination side. It's more with the market side. If you say, well, there's coordinated versus market, you can see the coordination, but then the market institutions are also coordinated. You know, they're organized. So that's the whole thrust of economic sociology, is in that direction. So in a way, we kind of think of varieties of capitalism and economic sociology as in the same project. But in some ways, there's a kind of a deep tension there. So just trying to work through what would it be like, you know, what would that kind of coordinated market look like in the different countries? And that becomes more salient as it becomes more marketized.
So, I was wondering, would David take the bait? But he has, so I'll give you the floor now. No, sorry, I didn't mean to.
No, the varieties of capitalism was written a long time ago, and I have a lot of sympathy for John's views about that. I have to say, I find this totally fascinating. I think this graph making markets real is such an interesting way of thinking about the two countries. I've very much liked your talk about the information technology. We studied biotech startups in Germany a long time ago, and then subsequently telecom startups around in Sweden around Red Chalmers and. I actually think that there are a lot of parallels between the way startups or small innovative companies worked in those countries to the way you're talking about Denmark. And I do think it is actually quite a different way to the way in which startups work in London, which we've been looking at, or Silicon Valley in the United States. Ireland is a special case because of the huge role of American multinationals in Ireland. It would have been very interesting to have done a comparison actually with Israel, as far as the whole question of startups goes, which is sort of close, is related to the Irish experience. It's less totally dependent on American markets. But I'd quite like to talk about innovation in the next session if I can. But I did want to say I thought this is a brilliant metaphor you have under in terms of this question of unique equilibrium or however markets work, when you talk about the unique equilibrium in Denmark being locked into a negotiation process, because I find that ties really well into some of John's stuff on Denmark, also to the way Per Christensen talks about how markets work in a more innovative type of environment. Anyway, so it's partly just so I this was not rising credit base at all. So it's absolutely, I think for rise of capitalism, the way it was done a long, long time ago in relation to very different.
Well, no, great. And it segues into the next session in a way. So I'll just give a quick response to Sean or Felix or both, and then we'll wrap for coffee.
Well, I'll just finish on this thing of the equilibrium then, because, well, I'm glad you found it interesting. But the other thing is that John asked about the erratic futures, and I suppose in a sense the future is kind of erratic and uncertain in general terms, but the question in a way is, can you construct a future that is more certain and kind of understandable? So I have a couple of ways I'm kind of coming at that from a couple of different things, but one is that there's a great short piece by Art Stinchcomb from years and years ago where he says he's talking about Tilly's work, and he says that institutions are ways of building solid enough futures. And that's inherently collective. Like, you know, it doesn't really matter what the future, like the future depends on other people's interactions with you. So then can you construct, in a way this is about constructing the future. And it's not just like, oh, we all have the same understanding of what the future will be. It's about actually constructing the future. Like, we will all be here again in 2 years or 3 years, and we will be fighting over this issue and this issue.
You can, of course, say that to Ireland, coming from the UK.
Right, yeah.
We will all be here again in a few years.
But in a way, what Joe was describing, the mobile interface periphery, is that that's probably hard to do anyway in Ireland because there's so much external uncertainties. Mm-hmm. But the way that they did it was just try and network into it and reduce the uncertainty and then give you some parameters that you can have your row about.
Okay. I'm pulled here because I know I'm getting lots of eyes for coffee and I'm getting... John, do you want to say something very quick? Okay, very quick.
With respect to your response to my question on erratic futures, you're basically saying that it's the institutions that's, relatively speaking, at least stabilize expectations about the future. So that, I can go with that. But then there's also Jens Beckert's recent article, or book rather, which is much more about sort of cognitive. His question is, how can you have capitalist rationality when we can never know what the future is? And his response is a much more, it's sort of one part bounded rationality, one part cognitive template, it's a very different kind of a spin on the answer to that question than what you just said. I'm not saying it's better or worse, but I'm saying it's something you might want to take into consideration when you, particularly if you're going to use that language.
Right.
Okay. Rory, would yours hold for the next one, or is it very related?
It's just tiny.
Going
that level is brilliant. Connecting that to the previous session, the erratic future, is partly within this firm and the career and the skills, and partly then the housing situation. and the child and family situation around that is also producing erratic futures.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks for making that so short, Rory. Okay, we'll leave it there before anybody else jumps in. And to thank both Felix and Sean for such an engaged response.